The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 23rd of September 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Daniel Bage. Coming up,
we very much want to see not only France, but all the nations of Europe, our like-minded nations in Europe, playing a very important role in the Indo-Pacific. That's what it means for Australia.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison wants to repair relations with the EU, following a decision to scrap a key submarine deal with France. But is Paris interested in mending ties? Also ahead, China has unveiled ambitious climate change targets at the United Nations in New York. We'll ask whether Beijing's bold proposals could be an environmental game changer. Plus, Monocle's editorial director Tyler Brulé joins us from Athens as our Quality of Life conference gets underway. And we'll even have time for Fernando Augusto Pacheco's Global Countdown. Any teasers for us, Faye?
Yes, Daniel. For today's countdown, of course, I had to pick Greece. So expect plenty of late summer sounds.
Looking forward to it. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Daniel Bage. We begin today's program in Australia, where the country's Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, says he is eager to repair relations with France. It follows his decision to scrap a major submarine deal with Paris in favor of a new one with the UK and the United States. The latest pact prompted the French to recall their ambassadors in Washington and Canberra, and Morrison has also revealed that the French leader, Emmanuel Macron, isn't returning his calls. Let's get the latest now with Karen Middleton, the Saturday paper's chief political correspondent in Canberra. Karen, where are things at today? Some reports, as I say, suggest the Elysee Palace is not picking up phone calls. So what is the PM saying about how he's going to fix this relationship?
Time, I think, Daniel. Time is the key. Yes, relations are very frosty now with the cancellation of what was a $90 billion Australian dollar contract, the biggest ever defence contract for Australia, with the French-owned company Naval Group. And the French government is particularly exercised about the manner in which that cancellation occurred, because it got no warning effectively. And there was suddenly just this announcement that Australia had joined a new partnership with the United States and the United Kingdom, this thing that's been abbreviated by their country's initials to AUKUS. And that involves the transfer of nuclear technology. It's the first time outside of its relationship with Britain that the US government has been willing to share that nuclear technology. And so that's what Australia is doing. But you're right. The Prime Minister isn't wanting to say directly that the French president won't take his calls, but they certainly haven't managed to schedule one just yet.
Well, as you say, it may take a little bit of time. Interesting to hear the comments from Boris Johnson in New York, a little bit bolder, kind of advising the French to get over it, as it were. And even the comments we heard from Scott Morrison off the top there suggesting that this is the way forward. That seems to be the tone from all the leaders in this AUKUS pact in dealing with China in a more proactive way, we can say, in the Indo-Pacific. So what is the government there saying about the role that Australia hopes to play?
Well, our Prime Minister's in the United States as well. He's in Washington for the upcoming first meeting of the Quad quadrilateral countries, the four countries that have now formed a security pact, and Australia's involved in that. So our government is mindful of what China is doing in the region and concerned about the aggressive stance that China has taken, and it's made this decision, it says, in the interest of security in the region, but it has caused a little bit of upset around the Indo-Pacific region here as well, because it was something that came out of the blue, and not many countries have nuclear capability with their submarines. And the Indonesian government has raised some concerns, the Malaysian government, but there are other governments around the region, including the Philippines and Singapore, that have said that they support and approve the move. So I think there's a bit of smoothing over to do, a bit of diplomatic work for Australia to do around this region. And certainly the Prime Minister in Washington has been doing a bit of that himself, both trying to talk to European leaders, because there's a European-Australian free trade agreement in the offing that now France may be seeking to derail as payback. And also the Australian government needs the support of people on Capitol Hill in Washington to back the legislation required to transfer the nuclear technology. So there's a fair bit of work for Australia to do to bed down this agreement. And it is very much pushing the idea that it is a stabilising thing for the region and not a destabilising one.
Well, on that point, how do you think regular Australians are seeing this deal? Are they happy to be in a defence pact? And obviously, there's a whole new capability for Australian defence here.
Yeah, I think people were surprised by it. We didn't have any warning that it was coming. There's a lot of preoccupation here with COVID-19, as there is in a lot of other places of the world. Half the country is locked down at the moment, so people are quite preoccupied with that issue. But it's getting a lot of coverage. There are questions about whether it's necessary. Nuclear technology has been a sensitive subject in Australia because we don't have a nuclear power industry here, and there's been a lot of hesitation about that. But interestingly, some of the opinion polls are starting to suggest that people's views might have shifted on that. So it may be that there's not the instant hostility that there might have been 5 or 10 years ago to the idea, but and certainly the community is very alive to the aggressive behaviour of China. And if you ask people, you know, the opinion pollsters ask people what they think about that, they tend to support pushing back against China. So if people see it in that vein, I suspect there won't be all that much criticism of it.
Karen, thank you for this. That was Karen Middleton in Canberra. Now here's Monocle's Chris Chermak with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Daniel. The World Health Organization has warned that air pollution is even more dangerous than previously thought. It comes as the UN body, which puts air pollution on a par with smoking and unhealthy eating, makes a concerted attempt to slash levels of harmful pollutants such as nitrogen dioxide. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says the country could end strict coronavirus lockdown measures once the vast majority of citizens are fully vaccinated. New Zealand eliminated COVID-19 last year and remained largely virus-free until an outbreak of the highly infectious Delta variant. Norway's centre-left parties are holding talks to determine whether they can form a majority coalition government. Labour, the Socialists and the Centre Party won a majority of seats in parliamentary elections earlier this month, but must now thrash out their policy differences on oil, tax and EU relations. And the 17th Zurich Film Festival, which is the second biggest in the German-speaking world, opens its doors today. The artistic director, Christian Jungen, has overseen a resurgence of Hollywood in the lineup this year. You can find out much more about it by heading to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Daniel.
Thanks very much, Chris. Now, much of the focus of this week's UN General Assembly has been on what the world can do to tackle climate change. One of the most radical proposals has come from the world's biggest polluter, China, which has promised to stop building coal-fired power stations abroad. President Xi Jinping says he also wants his country to be carbon neutral by 2060. Let's explore this further now with founder of China Dialogue, Isabel Hilton, also a regular voice here on Monocle 24. Isabel, good to speak to you. Some are cautiously welcoming this announcement today. What is China actually proposing?
Well, with China, you're never quite sure till the details get confirmed. And essentially what he said is that China will no longer build coal-fired power stations abroad. That's very welcome. It's a relatively easy win since the host countries are beginning to turn them down or cancel projects, and it's making China quite unpopular. But the detail matters, and the detail matters because there's a long pipeline. And what does this mean? Does it mean that the projects that have already started will not be completed? Does it only mean that projects that are still in the pipeline but where earth has not been broken will not be built? And does it mean that in addition to not building them, China will stop financing them, which I suspect it does mean, but that's not quite clear. So depending on the answer to all of those, you know, we can gauge the impact. It is a welcome announcement, but, you know, there's still a little bit to understand about what precisely it means.
Well, as you say, there is some question about what the president is actually saying here. And it's unclear if he meant state-funded projects or those also built by private enterprise, I think. So some concern there. But China has poured tens of billions of dollars into building these plants abroad, mostly in Asia. What is Beijing saying about alternative energy and what they'd replace these with?
Well, it's now proposing to support countries to find alternative ways of powering their development. And that's also important. On your private company point, I think that is important, but they would depend largely on state banks for finance and support. So, and given what China has done vis-a-vis very powerful private companies recently, I think if I were a private coal company, I probably try to conform with the new directive, because the consequences of not conforming with the directives have been rather severe. Going back to the alternative energy, now this would be a step change in China's approach to support for emerging economies. Hitherto, China has taken the rather kind of passive defense that when it's criticized for the low environmental and labor standards of its development projects, it has essentially said, oh, it's up to the host country to set the standards. And, you know, that's not really a good look if you are one of the major investors outside your national borders. And if what you're doing is locking countries into carbon-heavy projects, which will either become stranded assets or will contribute to climate change. To turn that around requires not only a mind shift in what the nature of Chinese development and investment is, but it also requires a transformation of the relationship between renewables companies, which tend to be in the private sector, and state banks and state investment. And that will be a very constructive thing if it happens. But there's a little way to go, I think, administratively for that to happen. And I think the second thing that we should note about that proposition is that if you're helping a country to build an energy sector with renewables, which is quite doable, and China's made a huge contribution by lowering the cost of renewables, you also have to get into grid management, which is rather more complicated than if you're just relying on fossil fuels. So there's a level of technical support that is demanded, which, if China is going to step up and deliver, would be transformative.
We mentioned off the top, I think, a stat everyone knows, in that China is the world's biggest polluter. But you don't have to go very far to see a few other countries that are also obsessed with coal. That's South Korea and Japan, which continue to work on new projects as well. They're big backers of coal plants. What is the conversation in the region on where China can actually be a leader in creating a radical shift?
Well, it would be important. South Korea and Japan are both problematic, though they both have beat China to the finish line in promising not to fund new coal overseas. And even in Japan, which is curiously wedded to coal, we are beginning to see a shift away. So in all three countries, there is a problem of a long-term commitment to coal, which now needs to be wound back. And that is, a lot of these coal plants are new. China continues to build new coal at home for, I think, energy security reasons. So that is a very big challenge that all three of them are facing. My sense is that Japan and South Korea will move slightly faster, mainly because the scale of the problem is less. But all three of them do need to act more quickly. And for in China's case, to meet its 2060 carbon neutrality target, which you mentioned, it's going to have to unwind its coal sector rather faster than it appears to be planning to do at the moment.
Isabel, thank you for this. That was the founder of China Dialogue, Isabel Hilton. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine, a global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine. Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. For 20 years, Novartis has been at the forefront in the battle to eliminate malaria, developing innovative therapies and new ways to provide access to healthcare. Together with international partners, the company has delivered more than 1 billion treatment courses of combination therapy and has contributed to reduce malaria deaths by nearly half since the millennium. Combination therapy is today's standard of care, and Novartis supplies more than 90% of its treatment without profit to malaria endemic countries. Dr. Caroline Bolton is the development head within Novartis, tasked with leading the charge for the next wave of innovative treatments for malaria. Caroline Bolton, thanks for being with us. Beyond treatments, what more can be done, Caroline, and indeed needs to be done to end malaria? Is it about ensuring the buy-in here from all stakeholders?
It's time for a call to action. We need to recognize that malaria is still taking more lives and still will continue to take more lives than most other diseases out there. It's completely preventable and treatable at this point in time. It won't be if we let it run away. But I think it is a case of true political will and global engagement to make sure that the resources are freed up and they are sustained so that not only do we get through the first little hump of trying to get the case numbers down, but we really have the momentum to follow this through, really to elimination and then eradication. And that is going to take another 40 years of commitment, I would guess, from the global community in order to do that. But I think we also need to look towards the experience with the eradication of other infectious diseases. There are other examples out there that we need to follow. What can we learn from those experiences? We know with malaria, if you don't maintain the commitment, if you don't continue with surveillance and follow-up of every imported case, malaria reestablishes itself. So we need to keep the foot on the pedal. We need to continue to strengthen in-country capabilities, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, so that they can really deal with this problem themselves rather than having people sitting in Europe and in the US trying to manage it remotely. And in order to do that, we need to make sure that they have the capabilities. And we need to support them with strengthening their surveillance, their tracking system, strengthening control measures, more focus on active planning, more focus on training the next generation of leaders that can lead this effort through to elimination. And one of the things we really value in working with consortia that we do, which are funded by EDCTP, such as Wanakantu and PAM-Africa, is that as well as developing our new agents, we also have the opportunity to help train the next generation of scientists and clinical trialists in Africa. And that, of course, is going to pay dividends forward as we're really creating that critical mass of trained professionals within sub-Saharan Africa who can then help to take the fight forward. All of these efforts will be critical to success, but really require patience and true long-term commitment.
Dr. Caroline Bolton, the development head within Novartis, tasked with leading the charge for the next wave of innovative treatments for malaria. An enduring commitment for more than a quarter of a century. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You're back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Bache. We're heading off to Greece now, where Monocle's team is gearing up for our Quality of Life conference in Athens. And I'm joined on the line by our editorial director, Tyler Brulé. Tyler, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Daniel.
You're going to kick things off later this evening, I understand, with the mayor of Athens with a little cocktail party. But knowing you, Tyler, I imagine you've had a very busy day already getting things ready, maybe snuck in a swim or a run. But what's the atmosphere like ahead of the conference?
Well, first, Daniel, no run yet. That's hopefully going to happen maybe a little later. A swim for sure, but all of the Monocle crew, not all of them, because, of course, you're back in London manning the fort, and, of course, there are people in our far-flung bureaus. But I would say there's about 26 of us in Athens at the moment. Everyone was at the Benaki Foundation bright and early this morning at 10 o'clock, really doing a run-through, technical and, of course, content run-through for everything that's going to be unfolding 24 hours from now. And that also meant looking at tables for stallholders, reviewing films, and also maybe challenging some heavy-handed social distancing measures as well. But definitely everything in hand.
What can we expect from this year's conference? Obviously, we want to shine a light on Greece and everything happening there, but what's on the agenda?
It's pretty broad. I think, of course, the Quality of Life Conference has evolved. Its core focus is always about the cities that we live in and what makes cities flourish, maybe where there's some points of failure within the urban environment as well. But of course, this is a special year, Daniel. We had 1 year out, of course, where we did not do the conference. So this is also, and we should probably also say, look at, Athens is a bit different. You know, we've been in Zurich before the conference. We've been in Vienna. We've been in Berlin. We've been in these cities, which of course are renowned for having an outstanding quality of life, that they always rank very well on global quality of life indexes. And we know that, of course, Athens has had its challenges. So I think here we also want to be able to look at and, of course, chronicle a number of things where you say, well, okay, maybe everything doesn't function perfectly, you know, in a city like Athens, but there are still so many extraordinary lessons that we can learn from a city like this, whether it's a green canopy, the use of awnings to cool terraces, cross breezes, and of course, you know, addressing some of the big challenges as well, the challenges of the neighborhood. When we think about, of course, you know, the neighbors, the Eastern Mediterranean, so we'll have a very good session with diplomats and of course, think tank observers as well, looking at also, you can have a great city, but you also have to be able to get along with people in your immediate community.
A packed agenda for tomorrow with some very fascinating panel talks that you'll be hosting or co-hosting with the team. But what else are you looking forward to? I've got Fernando standing by to run us through the top Greek tracks at the moment. I imagine the dance floor plays an important part of this weekend as well, Tyler.
Well, I mean, we'll hope so. Let's see. Greece, like so many places, Daniel has been through a bit of a roller coaster of easing of measures, clamping down. We're in a bit of a hybrid state at the moment, but I do believe whether it's going to involve drawn curtains or something, a DJ has been, our DJ Pitch seems to be our sort of resident traveling DJ. He traveled with us from Switzerland, so he's here from Zurich, so he's ready to go. I mean, if nothing else, Daniel, it's going to be some very gentle tunes over lunch and over the various dinners. And of course, the main thing is just seeing delegates. Of course, a lot of people have been to all five conferences. Almost every time we do an event, we have, of course, a Monocle hardcore who shows up. And a lot of these people we haven't seen for, you know, it's not been a year. It's been almost 2 years. So that's also going to be something which we're very much looking forward to. And even on the plane out, we had a number of a number of people also flying out with our team, not wanting to, of course, miss a moment.
Well, it's a packed week for Monocle. A brand new edition of the magazine out for October. The Monocle Book of Entrepreneurs is out, and now the Quality of Life Conference. Tyler, we appreciate your time and wish you the best of luck this evening. Hope everyone has a great time.
Thanks, Daniel.
That is Monocle's editorial director, Tyler Brulet, in Athens. Our Quality of Life Conference kicks off later. And I have a feeling we're going to stay with Greece for this week's edition of the Global Countdown. Fernando Augusto Pacheco is here with me in studio.
Fernando, what have you got to tell us about what is topping the charts in Athens and further afield?
Today was a no-brainer. I had to pick Greece. And Daniel, I was there in Greece recently. One of the interesting things, I was listening quite a lot to radio, you know, listening to it in bars. They do like their own artists. Because, you know, we discuss countries here. They usually have quite an international playlist. In Greece, they do like their acts, as you're going to see in the top five. Shall we start at number five, though?
Let's start at number five, yeah.
It's an interesting one because it has a Latin flavor to it. The song is called Dominicana Latina and is by a Greek rapper. His name is Nick, featuring Salva. They are both from Greece, but I think they are aiming for kind of like a Latin affair, perhaps in the Republic, the Dominican Republic. But let's have a clip of that song. Cristina eres diamante, Dominicana Latina, Elena su dicho por su sostina fina. María Cristina, ruta y te diga que por San Francisco domina. Dominicana Latina, Elena su dicho por su sostina fina. So basically, he's telling his girls, Dominicana Latina, let me show you around in Athens, you know, where I'm from. So it's quite an interesting, quite steamy and, you know, may I say sexy track as well from the Greek charts.
I like that one, probably playing a big part on the dance floors these days. What have you got for us at number four?
Number four is a special one. I think in Greece, like any other kind of Mediterranean country, so they have one song that defines their summer. Maybe some Greeks might say I'm wrong, but this song has been released in early July, you know, and it's been on the charts since then and it's still doing very well. It's by Nikos Vertis. He's Greek, but he was born in the Netherlands, in fact. This song, oh my God, I can guarantee that I'm sure, you know, he will be there on the Athens Quality of Life Conference. Let's have a listen. Nikos Vertis with S. Agapao, which means I love you. Lene, lene, posa pia na pun na halasun, vlepun de porun na echun, ότι εμείς γι' αυτό και μας ζηλεύουν. Σ' αγαπάω. I'm not gonna lie, I like it very much.
Yeah, it's
actually
catchy. It's much more of a Greek flavor to that one, I think. A little traditional, I like it.
And of course, in the video, he's in a pool party. I mean, where else Nikos Vertis would
course.
Be, right?
Yeah. At number three, what have we got?
Sorry, it's a little bit sad, this one, in fact. It's another Greek-American rapper. His name is Mad Clip. And it's very sad news. Earlier this month, he actually died in a car accident. Mm. He was one of the biggest names in Greek music at the moment. And of course, some of his songs are returning to the charts because of the news. I think, you know, people are very emotional. And it's interesting because he moved back to Greece. His parents were Greek. He moved back to Greece when he was only 13. And he used to sing in English. But then in the last years, he said, you know what, I'll start singing in Greek. I think there was an appetite for that. So, yeah, it is very sad. But I think we should pay tribute here to Mad Clip. This song is one of his biggest hits. It's from 2019, I believe, this track. It's called Gucci. Let's have a listen. Paying tribute there to Mad Clip and for all his fans.
Bittersweet. Hopefully a lot of people are still celebrating his life and his art by continuing to play his songs. Really nice one there. Thank you for that, Faye. What is in the number two position?
Number two is an interesting duo here because it's a mixture of hip-hop with pop music. We have Stavento, which is, you know, a Greek hip-hop band, but also Evie Adamou, which, you know, when I saw her name, I was like, I know her. She was representing Cyprus, actually, in the 2012 Eurovision. And I remember back then was one of my favorite tracks, La La Love, extremely poppy and very dancey. So it's interesting that she's partnering with Stavento, which is kind of a different rhythm that she used to sing. Let's see what we think about this track. So it's Stavento and Evie Adamou with For You.
I, I think a lot of people are going to be in traffic in Athens, windows rolled down with that one playing very loud. That's a good one.
Exactly. I mean, she's known in the region as a pop queen, you know, which is not a bad title to have.
Not bad at all for the region. Let's finish it off, of course, at number one.
Number one. Again, of course, we have to go back. It's also another track with Mad Clip. But this one, I have to say, is fairly recent. It's called Empore and it's called Maybe. Again, a very cool pop track, I would say, because he also partners with Eleni Fureira. She, you know, again, also former Eurovision contestant with the amazing song Fuego. And we featured Eleni Fureira. Our Athens correspondent Daphne Karnizis interviewed her. We picked her as one of the sounds of the summer. And here she is at number one with Mad Clip. It is bittersweet, but, you know, I think we should also celebrate that this song's at number one. Mm. Mad Clip and Eleni Fureira with Empore. Seres ya más pues venir te ya ti body na telina más te más y body ha te ya pisos ti stick me body na telina me. I like it. Let's keep playing that one. Absolutely. I mean, there's been some very good tracks here. And my pick, I would say, Daniel, I think number four, Nikos Vertis. I don't think our team in Athens will be able to avoid that one because it's been playing nonstop since July.
I'm sticking with number one. I mean, it's number one for a reason, I think. Fernando, thank you for that. That is the Global Countdown from Greece this week. That's our senior correspondent with me in studio, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing, produced today by Rhys James, our researcher, Sophie Monahan-Coombs. Our studio manager was Chris Ablakwa. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time, 1400 in Athens, midday here in London, 7 a.m. in New York City. I'm Daniel Bates. Goodbye, and thank you so much for listening.